That was my driving.
When Diane isn't with me at the GES conference, I'm kind of struggling to get everything done that's supposed to be done. Because I'll spend all night talking with people, and then it's, okay, there are all these things that need to be done, and it's, oh well. So Diane wasn't with me, and that was a real hard experience for me at GES this year. So let's pray. Father, we do thank you for your word. We thank you that it is able to critique our thoughts and our intents, so we can look at your word, and your word in turn critiques us and shows us that we didn't quite understand it and that we need to look at it again. I thank you for the way that your word is a standard that we can rely upon. And I pray that as we consider Revelation 3:10 in the way that you intended it, that the point will be clear and we will be able to help others who may be struggling on some issues as a result of misunderstandings of this verse. I pray that you would receive the glory as your word is clarified, and we pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. As all of you know, I am a grammarian, and I look for the anomalies in both Greek and Hebrew and end up becoming very puzzled. Why is this translated this way when this particular feature is rare? And so I'll look at a passage because I say, this just doesn't seem to be the common way that this phrase or this word is used or this construction. And one day I was reading Revelation and I thought, almost never is there a suspensive haughty. You say, what is a suspensive haughty?
It's an Indian friend of yours.
A suspensive haughty. It's a capitalized because. I'm going to illustrate the circuit. By the way, I remember when I was in seventh grade, my composition teacher said, don't start sentence with because. And so I didn't know why we shouldn't start a sentence with because, but I cleaned up my act, and I have never, ever, ever written a sentence in anything I turned into anyone that started with a capitalized because. So here I am reading in Revelation 3 in my Greek New Testament, and what do I see? I see a capitalized haughty. Well, capitalized haughties can exist. I ended up looking through my New Testament at all 1,100 uses of the word haughty. And it's a really exciting word. Most of the time, it's not translated at all. But you see after it the start of quotation marks. Or it might be translated that. Really exciting. It's either not translated or it's translated that 700 times. And then there are 400 uses where it's translated either because or for. And of the times that it would be translated with a capitalized because, there are only about 10 occurrences in the whole New Testament. So, I decided to take a closer look. I'm going to pretend right now that we're looking at a manuscript. So you can imagine with me that we have three propositions. The first proposition says, I ate breakfast. And the second proposition says, because I was hungry. And the third proposition says, I also ate an early lunch. Now the question is, am I saying I ate breakfast because I was hungry? Period. I also ate an early lunch. Or am I saying I ate breakfast? Period. Because I was hungry, I also ate an early lunch. So notice what happens. When you have the capitalized because, it doesn't modify the same thing. I wrote a rather humorous version of this where I said, I ate breakfast because I was hungry. I devoured the newspaper. And it really ends up being funny if you have a capitalized because in a circumstance like that. So the fact that this is a rare feature made me to just start to look at the passage a little more closely. There are two views of the rapture that end up liking the punctuation as it normally is, with a capitalized because and a period ending verse 9. The first view is the one that I hold, which is the pre-tribulation rapture. All church-age believers will be raptured, whether they are alive at the time of the rapture or dead. They will be caught up or brought down to the clouds, whichever applies. But there is a partial rapture view, and this verse, Revelation 3:10, is one of their favorite passages, because they say, because you have kept my command to persevere, I will deliver you from the hour. So the partial rapture says, if you, Christian, are not as faithful as the Philadelphians, watch out. You might be left for at least part of the tribulation. Now, when you talk to partial rapturists, you start finding out that they might have hundreds of raptures. There's the big one there at the beginning, but then the Lord looks long and he says, oh, some people got serious. Rapture them. Oh. A week later, oh, there's another rapture. And a week later, there's another rapture. And so it's kind of interesting when you talk to partial rapturists. They say, as soon as you become as faithful as the Philadelphians, you're out of here. Well, then there's another approach. And this would be represented by people like John MacArthur that are basically dispensational, but have merged that with a perseverantist type of view, a reformed type of soteriology. So if you were wondering how does the rapture fit here into a conference on Calvinism, that's how. And so what they say is, well, all church-age believers, all true church-age believers will be raptured. But they say, if you're not as faithful as the Philadelphians, well, you're not really a Christian. So you can see how it's very easy, because of the punctuation and the way that the text is set up, for people to reach either of those conclusions and to think that the passage is conditioning being raptured upon the degree of faithfulness. Now, there's a peculiar thing, and I have noted this all the way through the King James and New King James. You know, I don't mind getting bored to tears doing very tedious work. Mm-hmm. Although, I tell you what, I didn't actually look them all up. What I did was, I wrote a routine in the computer to make sure that every single verse in the King James and New King James, every single verse starts with a capital letter. Every single one. So even if they have a sentence that goes on for more than one verse, every verse gets capitalized. They had a predisposition that made them reject the punctuation that was in the Greek text that they were using. And their predisposition was to believe that every verse was intended as a complete sentence. I found something very interesting. I found that there are 7 sentence fragments in the New King James Bible as a result. Just a really funny thing that they've got 7 sentence fragments. I have a list of them at home. I didn't bring the list with me. They had such a strong predilection to the idea that a verse was supposed to be a sentence that sometimes they ended up producing sentence fragments. Now, as a result, they looked at Revelation 3:10 and they said, by golly, the sentence is going to start at the beginning of the verse. And here I am saying, there are about 400 uses of the word hati, translated because or for, and only 10 of those, actually I can find 16 places where commentaries have argued that there should be a capitalized because, but I have not found any commentator or any translation that has more than 10 capitalized becauses in the New Testament. So, down near the bottom of the page, if, number one, Revelation 3:10 starts a sentence, and two, if its first word, hati, should be translated capitalized because, the grammar would be highly unusual. Only about 10 sentences in the New Testament would match this grammar. On the other hand, if verse 9 were to end in a comma, and the first word in verse 10 were translated because as a lowercase because, there are almost 400 sentences that match this grammar. Now, I knew that first, the King James and New King James sometimes artificially began new sentences at verse breaks, and second, that this created odd grammar for Revelation 3:10. Therefore, I experimented with ending verse 9 with a comma. Now that would read, indeed, I will grant that those of the synagogue of Satan who say they are Judeans but are not, but lie, behold, I will make them know that I have loved you, comma, because you have kept my word to persevere. Period. And I will keep you from the hour of trial which shall come upon the whole inhabited world to test the earth dwellers. Now, the repunctuated text made sense. But that doesn't prove that it's right. So now we have to, once I discovered that, then that it would make sense if it had the normal usage of this word hati as a lowercase because, then it was necessary to start to figure out how to work this. And I moved this illustration before. You notice they're all capitalized, like Greek manuscripts, and there's no punctuation like Greek manuscripts, but I split them up like poetry into 3 separate lines. Well, the Greek New Testament wouldn't do that. But do you know what the circumstance that we most often find a capitalized because? It's when our kids come up to us and say, because you said this, and because of this, and because I knew this, and because, and because, and because, and say, get to the point. What did you do? It's called suspensive. Because you're trying to suspend getting to the main point and put out all the reasons that the listener should say, okay, I'll let you off the hook even though you did what you weren't supposed to do. That's why capitalized because is a rare type of thing. It tends to be reserved for people who are trying to escape consequences. So it's not a particularly common feature of grammar to have capitalized because. Now, for those of you who are grammarians, the only place where suspensives are common is with conditional statements. We usually say if, then. We hardly ever say then if. So the if clause is a dependent clause, and it's when you put a dependent clause first, that's when you call it a suspensive sentence, and if then is far more common than then if, but that's the only circumstance where it's common to put the dependent clause first. Now we'll get back to no grammar. So those of you who like grammar, we had a point, now we're moving away from that for a moment. So, I conclude right before I talk about view one reinforces. If this were my only argument, I could say the New Testament uses hati, lowercase because, in the way that view one interprets it about 400 times, but in the way that view two interprets it, capitalized because, only 10 times. The evidence favors view one, but does not disprove view two. So now we need to look, how is it that I would prove that it should be a lowercase because? Well, the first feature is that within verse 8b, we have the following phrase, "You have kept my word." He says, "I have set before you an open door, and no one can shut it for," and I skipped what was intervening, "you have kept my word." Now, the open door represents opportunity for ministry. The Lord has opened this door because despite having only a little strength, and I misspelled strength, they have kept his word and did not deny his name. They are under pressure. They are under persecution from these people that falsely claim to be Judeans. And they are putting a lot of pressure, and they seem to be a stronger group. And the Philadelphians have not caved in. And they have kept his word. They have not denied his name, despite all the pressure that they are getting. But now when we look at verse 10, "You have kept my word, my command," they have translated in the New King James as command. I think this is a place where they should have left it as word to help us see that there's a continuity with verse 8. Literally, it says, "You have kept the word of my perseverance." And I would say that's an acceptable paraphrase to "of my perseverance" to render it as an infinitive and say "to persevere." Because despite all the pressure that they're getting from the synagogue of Satan, they have not caved in. I think that the translators have gotten a little confused because verse 10 has the word "keep" twice. "Because you have kept my command to persevere," or "the word of my perseverance, I also will keep you from the hour." So they see the word "tereo," the word "keep," and they say, "Oh, well, this belongs together as a sentence." Well, let me ask a question. What does it mean to keep the word? You obeyed. But what does it mean, keep from the hour? That's deliverance. So I would say verses 8 and 10a are the ones that are close together. And the meaning that is associated with "keep from the hour" is a whole different semantic idea. And that's not the one that should be joined. And so this leads, logically, if we tie verse 8 in with verse 10, that leads logically to us punctuating verse 9b as ending in a comma and verse 10a starting with a lowercase word. So we start out the sentence. I will make them, that is of the synagogue of Satan, know that I have loved you because you have kept my word to persevere. Note the phrase, you have kept my word, appears in both verse 8 and verse 9. The first time, he does not say to persevere, but he says that they, despite having only a little strength, have not denied his name, but they have kept his word. He said, you are not as strong as those people that are persecuting you, and yet you haven't caved in. You know, that certainly sounds like 21st century United States. The forces that are opposed to Christianity are all over us, and they have power, and they seem to be grabbing more and more power, and despite us having a Constitution and Bill of Rights, and all sorts of things that on paper would look like we'd have all the protections we want. Yeah, it's like, what is happening? You know, I mean, I can look at the Philadelphia church, and it's a relatively small place there in a leading city of Asia Minor, but you know, they were getting hit real hard, and Jesus is praising these people, for they are not backing down. They are sticking with the word, and they are still having active proclamation of it, so he gives them an open door. This is not a time, making a little application, for us to be thinking about doing anything other than what the Philadelphians were doing. We need to stand firm and pray that the Lord will open doors to minister to people with the message of life, despite what's going on around us and despite all the discouragements. He says, this is what I want. I want for people to use their little strength rather than to back down and pull away and have his word not go forth. So what does he do? He opens a door for them because they are already using the opportunity rather than running with their tails between their legs. So then, what does he say there in verse 9b through 10a? He's saying, I'm going to let your persecutors know that I love you. How's he going to do that? Is he going to say, put a big heart on the house where they're meeting and say, God loves these people? Or is it going to be that God is going to be protecting them from the persecution? He's going to be guarding their hearts through the word and giving them a strength to be able to continue to use the open door that he's putting before them. I think that he's going to give them a standing in front of those people, and who knows, even some of their persecutors might come to believe in Jesus Christ. So, I would say that view one makes more sense than verse two. Looking at the very bottom of the page, the Lord gives ministry opportunity, the open door, despite opposition, because they have kept his word, and the Lord will also vindicate them before their persecutors and give them more ministry opportunity because they kept his word. Does it really make sense? You are standing up. I'm going to jerk you out of here. Does that seem like the logical thing for him to say at this point? I don't think that it's the logical first step. The way that I see verse 10b, when he talks about deliverance, is he says, I won't abandon you. But meanwhile, they're supposed to use that open door, and I would see him reinforcing that open door that they are to have because the Lord has seen them to be faithful in adhering to his word and not denying his name, and he is giving them an open door as long as he leaves them there. That seems to make better sense of the context. Page 3. So view 1 has the advantage of continuing the line of thought from verse 8. Now there's a word in there, a compound word. Doesn't look like it's long enough to be a compound word. It's kago. It's a compound of kai and ego. Ego means I. Kai means and. So I and I. Under the normal punctuation, I looked at that and I looked at that. And, you know, I diagram everything. I do my grammatical diagrams and I'm saying, I just don't find the New Testament having an and that's part of a connection with a dependent clause. This is like, if this is having the normal punctuation, because you have kept my word, the word of my perseverance, and I will keep you. And it's like, how does that and fit in there? Yeah, it's really odd. And even when it's made a little more innocuous by being translated also, it's like, why is that there? And it's just as a real puzzlement, and I don't see passages that do that. I mean, I diagram all the way through the whole New Testament, and I look, and I look, and I look, and I say, this just is rare, this is weird, this is really, really strange. So, kai, the word and, normally connects like elements. And so it will connect two nouns, two verbs. Like I could say, I'd like to have ham and eggs. I mean, that and fits really nicely between the two nouns, ham and eggs. By the way, you do know that there is a difference between ham and eggs. The chicken is involved, but the ham is committed.
You mean the pig. Yeah. The pig is committed.
Yes, yeah. The pig. And so it normally will connect two like elements, two nouns, two verbs, two independent clauses that could be full sentences, or two dependent clauses. But it doesn't hook up an independent clause and a dependent clause. Dependent clause starting with because. If I say, because you have kept the word of my perseverance, that's not a sentence. It's a sentence fragment. So that's a dependent clause. Do we really expect it to say, to have an and in between a dependent clause and an independent clause? It's like, what is that and doing there?
Right.
It's really strange and it's really rare.
My NIV leaves it out.
Okay, sure. They're saying we can't make sense of it. And so almost never does it connect an independent clause like in the normal punctuation Revelation 3:10b with a dependent clause like 10a. Such usage here for view 2 would be quite unexpected. A simpler solution exists under view 1. And notice the first person verbs, all the uses of I. I know your works. I have set before you an open door. I will grant to those of the synagogue of Satan. I will make them know. And I will keep you from the hour. The and makes much more sense if John is intending to use it to connect the independent clauses with I. I've done this, I've done that, and I will do this. That's a far more logical understanding of what the and is doing. And my punctuation that puts a comma at the end of verse 9 and a period in the middle of verse 10 does exactly that. So let's read the passage. And I'll emphasize the word I and the verb that follows. I'll read from the New King James. I know your works. See, I have set before you an open door, and no one can shut it. For you have a little strength, have kept my word, and have not denied my name. Indeed, I will make those of the synagogue of Satan, who say that they are Judeans, and are not, but lie. Indeed, I will make them come and worship before your feet, that is, worship me before your feet, that they will be embarrassed in front of these people, and some of them may even come to recognize the falsity of their teaching. And to know that I have loved you because you kept my command to persevere, period. And I will also keep you from the hour of trial, which shall come upon the whole world to test those who dwell on the earth. In other words, what I see is that the connection between points 1 and 4 is a comma in English, but the connection between the fourth and fifth of these propositions would be an end. And this is in keeping with normal grammatical use for a word like and. It would be connecting like things. I will, I will, I will, and I will.
John?
Yes.
The conclusion. In other words, the connection between and the 1 to 4 are not verses, they're points.
Points. Yes.
Okay, so the points 1 and 2, 3 and 4 is a comma. But the connection between the fourth and fifth points?
Yes.
It's the and. Okay.
Yes, yes.
Points.
Right.
Is an and.
Right.
Okay. Oh, yeah. All right, now I see it. Thank you.
The reason that I ended up putting those that way is because notice how long some of these verses are. And so I was saying, verse such and such D, and so on and so forth. So I just stayed with my notes and used the points in the notes there for my numeration. Now, summary of the evidence. The grammar of view one is quite ordinary. It is only very rarely that English Bibles or even English writing starts a sentence with a capitalized because. And we talked about the suspensive use. Because you said it. Because of this rule and because of this. Where it's trying to hold off an unpleasant punchline. It's very rare. So likewise, the word and, which starts verse 10b, most naturally connects like items, the I with the verbs, those propositions. Thus, for it to link first verse, first person verbs is expected. While the traditional punctuation creates something most unusual, then the repetition of the phrase, because you have kept my word, fits most naturally under the view that Christ opens doors of opportunity for a faithful church and vindicates them before their persecutors. The traditional punctuation does not flow as naturally. So the traditional punctuation is not the best grammatical solution, and it doesn't really flow as well as punctuating this differently.
In the Greek, there's no punctuation.
Yeah, there was no punctuation. All punctuation and capitalization is an editorial decision.
Okay.
And I make that one of the things that I question.
Okay. It is an editorial decision in going from Greek to English.
Well, it's an editorial decision in creating a Greek text.
Oh, all right. And all the way back to the Greek text.
Okay. Right, because Greek texts have
Greek texts, not the original.
Yeah,
right. Yes, Diane.
Tell them a little bit about how it originally was. There was no punctuation.
Yeah, they wrote all caps. They filled up their page because writing material was extremely expensive. The cheapest price that we can document would have a standard scroll of papyrus selling for the equivalent of a day's wages for a common laborer. And you say, okay, well, how big is a standard scroll? Well, a standard scroll would be about 20 sheets in length. And you say, okay, well, help me out. If it were written in scroll form, which I would argue that the autographs, and up until late in the first century, all the manuscripts would have been written on scroll form. Scrolls, okay, just since we're in Revelation, look at Revelation 5:1. And I saw in the right hand of him who sat on a throne a scroll written inside and on the back, sealed with seven seals. We read that and we say, okay, that's nice. That's a scroll and it was written on both sides. But let me point something out. At this time, they were using papyrus scrolls. You could not roll papyrus more tightly than about this or you would start breaking it. But beyond that, papyrus was in two plies, so similar to plywood. And they would have the fibers at right angles to each other. Now, if you roll with the lengthwise ones on the outside, it tends to hold up a long time. But if you roll with the vertical fibers on the outside, it tends to spread them apart and break it down. So therefore, papyrus scrolls were only rolled in one direction. Second point, it's not until the 8th century that writing desks became common. So I hadn't planned on this, but I'll grab a chair because it'll be easier for you to see. The traditional posture for a scribe is basically like this. And you had your scroll in your lap. And so you've got the two gathers, and assuming that the person is right-handed, as I am, the left hand covers over both gathers, and the right hand is writing in between. And they would stretch their knees in order to make their robe tighten to serve as a better writing surface. There are three places in the Bible where epistographs, an epistograph is where a scroll is written on both sides. They were exceedingly rare. Now, that creates an interesting problem, because if you have a scroll and you're only writing it on one side, and it's papyrus because it's two plies, there ends up being a maximum vertical height simply because they're peeling from the papyrus plant and the outside material and the very inside material is junk. They can only use a certain amount of it. They ended up with a maximum page size. But besides that, you know, I'm someone who sits down tall. If I stand up short. I've got short legs. But those scribes had even shorter legs than I do, because they were shorter than I am. And they had to be able to fit their scroll and support it with their robe, so you couldn't have a big sheet of papyrus in your lap if you're writing. And so what it works out, and besides that, most of their church services were in the evening, so they had to write big because they had the candlelight by which they were trying to read after it was dark. And that's, by the way, when you read about Eutychus, it says there were many lanterns, there were many torches. It was nighttime, and how do you see to read your scroll if you don't have a fair amount of light, and they're burning up all the oxygen, and Eutychus was there sitting in the window saying, I want some fresh air, and all of a sudden he took the flight. And so what you end up with is the maximum that you could hold in a standard papyrus scroll, if you didn't glue another one on the end of it, was half the Book of Mark. And that would cost you a day's wages for common labor. So let's pretend 10-hour working days, $10 an hour, no overtime, $100 for the writing material to hold half the Book of Mark. So, what you're looking at is something that communicates to me how motivated the church was to distribute the word, because we have 5,000 surviving Greek manuscripts. And you start looking at that, guess why Diane and I are actively involved in distributing the living water. We see the people of the New Testament being motivated to get the word out. This church in Philadelphia was motivated to do so, even though they only had a little strength. They were under a lot of persecution, but they were continuing to get the word out. Now, I do not see this technically as a rapture passage. I'll tell you why. Jesus promises to deliver the first century Philadelphians and not let them enter the hour. Okay. Did he rapture them?
No.
What was the means by which they did not enter the tribulation? They died. Notice he promises to keep them from entering the hour. He does not specify the means of deliverance. Every generation of the church, up until the final generation of the church, will be prevented from entering the tribulation via physical death.
Yes, that's great. That's good.
The final generation of the church will have its pre-trib deliverance by means of the rapture. What he's promising is not to allow them to enter that hour. And so the passage has relevance to the rapture, but it is not technically a rapture passage. When we look at 1 Thessalonians 5, that is a rapture passage. And what Paul tells us there in 1 Thessalonians 5:9 is that God did not appoint us, and I would take it that the us in that context is a broader reference than just to the Thessalonian church, because he's including himself, and it's a reference to he has not destined the church for that. So the rapture has to be prior to wrath, and we're not able to take the time to argue that wrath characterizes the entire 7 years, so therefore I unapologetically argue for a pre-trib rapture. But this passage is set up to say, you only have a little strength. You've kept my word. You have not denied my name. I will put an open door before you. I'll give you ministry opportunity because you are remaining faithful to my word. He wants them to get the word out. That's what we ought to be doing. That's why all those living waters ought to disappear. Because we need to put them in the hands of people who need them. We shouldn't be worried about the persecution that we have coming and cause us to pull back in fear. We're going to be talking about that at length when I speak tomorrow morning, and I'm talking about Romans 8. That's going to be an important and I think an eye-opening passage. But he says, I'm going to make your persecutors know that I have loved you because you have kept the word of my perseverance. But I'm not just going to let you suffer and face the hour of trial, the tribulation. I will deliver you. He didn't specify how he was going to deliver them. But the means by which he delivered them was through their physical death. And he makes a promise there that is not conditioned upon, are we as faithful as the Philadelphians? This passage lends no support to the partial rapture view, and it lends no support to the dispensational perseverantist approach either. So I think it's a very simple passage. If we deal with the grammar in ordinary ways, and if we understand it in keeping with the flow of the argument. Yes?
I must have left my brain at the door, but it just still seems like if what you're saying, V2 is correct.
No, V1.
V1 is correct. Where did I?
V1 repunctuates and puts a comma at the end of verse 9, has a lowercase because, and puts a period in the middle of verse 10, and should change the word also to and.
Okay.
So he's saying, I will make those of the synagogue of Satan know that I have loved you because you have kept the word of my perseverance, period. And among the other things that I will do for you, I will keep you from the hour.
Okay.
He has not linked it to their degree of faithfulness. He has made an unconditional promise. A promise there that would be in keeping with what he has said in 1 Thessalonians. 1 Thessalonians is clearly giving a rapture passage. That is a specified means of deliverance. Let me say something else. Physical death serves for all generations of the church prior to the final generation as a means of preventing them from entering the hour. But the rapture is the means by which people get their resurrection bodies, and the whole body of Christ is brought together to be with Christ in the clouds. So when you look at 1 Thessalonians, you find that there is a benefit both for the living and for the dead to be raptured. But that isn't John's topic, or that isn't what Jesus is talking about here as he is telling the Philadelphians, yes, I want you to keep doing as you've done here during this terrible time of persecution, but I'm not going to leave you stranded. I'm not going to let you enter the hour. But he didn't specify when the hour was going to come, and he didn't specify the means by which he would prevent them from entering the hour.
And the rapture's for the dead people, for the dead church too. They're, we're delivered through death. Who wants to live?
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad that I'm not going to live. If Jesus tears is coming, I don't want to. I'm already 70, and I'm can't even walk these hills. I don't want. If I was 20, I would.
Yeah.
But the death is deliverance in a lot of ways. At 70, I see it.
Sure.
But I'm going to, if I die, I'm going to be resurrected.
Yep.
That rapture is great news for me if I die.
Right.
Yeah.
John's topic is not the rapture.
Right.
His topic here is, I'm not going to leave you. I'm not going to abandon you. I'll deliver you, but he doesn't say how.
Yeah.
Yes?
Are you the only one that holds this view, or are there others?
Pretty neat. I'm the one who proposed it, and it's being accepted. It shows up in some footnotes in Jody Dillo's Final Destiny. He told me when he heard, or when he read my article way back when, I published a long time ago on this.
Is this in the journal, the Grace Journal?
No, it was in CTS Journal.
Okay.
What?
CTS Journal, Schaefer Theological Seminary Journal. And so it appeared as two installments in 2000. We can get you a link to be able to look at the electronic version of my two-part articles. But when Jody Dillo read it, he said, I wanted to include Revelation 3:10 in Reign of the Servant King, but he said I wasn't quite sure how to get around the perseverantist view without endorsing a partial rapture view. So he said, now I see the solution is simple. So it ended up appearing in Final Destiny. So only as a couple of short footnotes, he doesn't devote much space to it. But and Bob, and there are others who have accepted it, but essentially, I just looked and said, this is rare grammar.
Yeah.
I mean, I get puzzled by things that are weird. And I end up looking at them, and then sometimes, oh, well, you know, there's a simple solution. So it requires spending a lot of time diagramming and looking at the New Testament and saying, this is strange. Why did this happen this way? Or did we interpret it the right way? And I end up finding that a lot of the times that it's real rare, it really isn't, because it's something other than what people thought it was when they created this rare grammar by their punctuation or whatever they did. Yes, Bill.
The partial rapture dispensational perseverance views aside, we've heard some discussion that those that might be all millennial that don't believe in a rapture at all are going to have to go through the tribulation. Is there any scriptural support for that at all?
Well, the only views that pay attention to when the rapture is and distinguish it from the second coming are premillennialists.
Right.
Everybody else ends up equating second coming with rapture, of course, with the exception of the preterists, the hardline preterists who don't see anything happening there. And so they end up having to somehow insert a tribulation type of idea and expect that all believers potentially face that, and they have to treat wrath in 1 Thessalonians 5 as lake of fire and so on and so forth. But when you do a study on the word orge, the word wrath, there is no clear place at all where one could say it would be talking about anything after history. And I would say my own position would be far stronger, saying that none of them could conceivably refer to anything after the close of history. Yes?
Now, these believers, they had just seen, were they aware in Philadelphia of the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD? Why are they thinking that the hour is coming? Is it because things are really bad?
Well, Jesus is the one who brought that up. My date for the book of Revelation is not a common one. I believe that the book of Revelation was written between 71 and 72. So I hold to a very unusual view. Let me ask a question. Where was President Clinton born?
Hope, Arkansas.
Arkansas, yeah.
No, he wasn't born. He wasn't born when he was president. Okay. We have all sorts of church writers that say the Emperor Domitian is the one who exiled John Patmos. But the question becomes, when you have people who are writing long afterwards and they say the Emperor Domitian did it, have they in a statement like that affirmed?
You mean John, the Apostle John?
John the Revelator.
Yeah, not the
not John not the Baptist.
You said John the Baptist.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
If I have no idea how a statement like that. Anyway, whatever. For church history writers to say that the Emperor Domitian is the one who exiled him does not of itself affirm that he was emperor when he did it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh.
Now, we have a most interesting letter that very few people are aware of, and it is fascinating. You remember how Vespasian was conducting the Judean campaign there that ended up with the siege against Jerusalem. But as they were in the early stages of that, he was recalled to Rome. So he went to Rome. And he left Titus in charge in order to conduct the siege against Jerusalem. But as often happens, there were people that said, you know, they've got an army that's all tied up there in Judea going after Jerusalem. So the city of Alexandria said, what an opportune time to have a rebellion. And Vespasian went down there. So who's sitting on the throne? Oh, we've got this fascinating letter. It is just fascinating. Vespasian came back to Rome after having defeated the rebels down there in Alexandria, and he wrote to Domitian and he said, he cataloged all the excesses that this teenager was doing. I'll arrest this person, I'll do this, you know, it's law after law after law. I mean, he was just going to town. And Vespasian said, well, at least you didn't usurp the throne. Huh. I see, as I look at things, a golden opportunity for a teenager to let power go wild. And he was doing this and he was doing that. And I am able to reconcile everything that's going on with the Book of Revelation being written there during that time that Domitian is acting emperor. So it's an unusual view, but
acting emperor in Rome. Domitian is acting emperor in Rome.
Yes.
And about 71 or 72?
71, 72.
Because Vespasian, what's
his
name?
Vespasian.
Has gone to Egypt.
Yes.
Why wouldn't he send someone else to go to Egypt?
He's a young man, right? Vespasian is young.
No, Domitian.
Oh, Domitian is the one, is the young one.
Yes.
And so.
And he later becomes emperor.
Yeah, in Rome. And he's the acting emperor.
Yes.
Because of that rebellion where.
Oh, and it's a fascinating one.
Fascinating theory. Gosh, I've never heard it before.
The fall of Jerusalem or the siege of Jerusalem might be fresh on their minds. In 71, it's a year.
Asia Minor is a little bit of a backwater, and they would not necessarily have yet known about it. One of the things that is important, there's a book written by a liberal that I like to pay attention to because he had lots of good things. Zane quotes him regularly, J.A.T. Robinson.
Yeah.
J.A.T. Robinson reshaped New Testament scholarly thinking on a number of issues. And one of the things that he argued was that he couldn't make sense of any book of the New Testament being written after 70, because the question there is, why didn't the New Testament treat the destruction of Jerusalem as a fait accompli, as an apologetic for the message?
Oh, yeah, that's true.
whether one is looking at the Synoptic Gospels or Hebrews, none of them treats it as a fait accompli.
Which means what, John?
An accomplished fact.
Fact, okay.
And Robinson said that was a golden opportunity that would be missed if they did not use it. And in my sense, I would expect for Jesus to, it would be a golden opportunity for him to say, in describing the tribulation, that terrible thing that you know about that happened in Jerusalem, that wasn't even a drop in the bucket compared to what's coming.
Hmm. Wow.
Yeah, he didn't say that.
And that's not said. But if the book of Revelation were written to people who are in a bit of a backwater, that aren't in the main channel of communication, if they had been in Rome, that would be well known what was going on. But they're sort of in a backwater, with John being on an island and the churches being a little bit out of the mainstream of where the communications are all going. And if they knew about it, it would seem like Jesus would say, in this chapter 6 through 9, that I'm talking about, it'll make what happened in Jerusalem seem like nothing.
Yeah. Well, the printer is the other. Man, everything they have has to have it written before.
Right.
Nearly everybody knows there's no way it was written before 7.
Right. Well, my date, there are people who argue for a Neronic date. Oh. But my date is a little later than Zane's date. So I do hold a different position than Zane.
Zane had it before 7?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Zane did hold to every single book being written before 70. I hold to every book except Revelation being written before 70, but Revelation being written only slightly after 70.
Wow.
And is cool. There a church history book by this Robinson guy?
Well, redating the New Testament, and the cheapest way to get it is through Wipfenstock. WIPF and Stock. In Eugene, Oregon, and so they have done a reprint, paperback reprint.
Okay.
And Robinson does talk about this letter by Vespasian, but he rejects it because he was a preterist. So he needed a pre-70 date.
Wasn't he Southern Baptist? I thought 18.
No, he was Anglican.
From England?
Yeah.
Okay, well, the Southern Seminary just, they revere him. I mean, Louisville.
Yeah, well, I guarantee you, the priority of John shook up New Testament scholarship on John's gospel and did so in some wonderful ways.
Who was the great teacher at Southern in Louisville? He quoted A.T. all the time. Oh, my dad, I can't.
A.T. Robertson is quite distinct from J.A.T. Robinson.
Oh, okay.
They're quite distinct people.
Okay, that's where I'm making my mistake.
J.A.T. Robinson.
Yeah, John A.T. Robinson.
Robinson, and my background is with A.T.
Yeah, I'm glad we clarified that.
What's the name of the article we get at Wipfenstock?
Wipfenstock is a publisher.
And what's the name of the book then?
Oh, Redating the New Testament.
Okay.
I own a first edition. I only went through one edition through SPK in England, and so I have a copy that normally sells for 75 and up, but the Wipfenstock one is, I think, 35 or 40, so it's considerably cheaper.
Yeah.